Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to what is going to be the September 16th, 2012 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard. This is my first pre-recorded podcast. It's the podcast that's devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism. The special episode that we have today is an interview with Leonard Peikoff. He is the author of the recently released book, The Dim Hypothesis: Why the Lights of the West Are Going Out. It was just released on September 4th, and if you want to get it, there's going to be a link at my blog, don'tletitgo.com, at the post for this particular show. And, of course, you can also find the link at Leonard Peikoff's website, which is peikoff.com, P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F.com. Leonard, thanks for joining us.
Well, fine. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I want to start out just by getting out on the table the general premise of the book. And in the book, you talk about the ability to analyze a culture and make predictions about the direction in which a culture is going based on identifying the culture's predominant epistemological process. Now, this is my language. I'm not quoting you, so you can tell me if I mess up here. But in other words, you're talking about the process by which the culture as a whole generally obtains knowledge, not necessarily its substantive conclusions, but the processes that the people use in reaching their conclusions. And
I want
to, go ahead. No, jump in.
I wouldn't put it to quite that narrowly. You're making it a cognitive issue of how people reach conclusions. That's a part of it, but I'm talking about any creative human activity, whether they're pursuing knowledge, writing fiction and just imagining information, putting together laws into a constitution, putting together experiments into a physical theory. So some of that is cognition and some of that is not is imagination. Some is just organization of what's already known. So it's broader than that. What the common denominator is the process of integration, of which I've just given examples, putting things together, which is the essence of the human mind, the essence of human consciousness. That's called integration, which I symbolize by I. And I say that that is the fundamental process of the human mind in all of its activities, intellectual or existential. And then I say that there are three possible ways to perform this process, and only three. Integration, meaning rational integration. Integration based on facts of reality and logic, the evidence of the senses. That's what I call I. Mm-hmm. Then there is integration which is not based on sensory observation and logic, but on some form of connection other than that, usually God, but not necessarily God. That's what I call misintegration, and I symbolize that by M. Then what is left is the people who oppose integration, whose approach to all phenomena is to tear things apart, to stop things from being integrated, to produce the opposite of integration. And that is actually nihilism, the desire to destroy. And the only way you can destroy a human achievement is to tear it apart. And that is what I symbolize by D. So D-I-M, the letters are in no order other than ease of pronunciation. stands for those three forms, or I call it modes of thought. And then what I do is trace, I take four subjects, literature, physics, education, and politics, and trace what is the dominant mode of thought operative in successive cultures from Greece, Rome, medieval period, all the way on up to the present, and then try to discover what are the patterns and what they imply for the future. That's in essence.
Okay, now, just to rephrase part of my question before, the content of these various cultural products, whether it's actually, you know, reaching epistemological conclusions or, you know, creating a work of art, et cetera, it's not the content that you're looking at, but the way in which the mind is creating these,
yeah, the
right?
mode of integration.
Right, right.
Whether it comes up with... for instance, I think the Soviet literature and medieval literature, Soviet propaganda and medieval morality plays, they're diametrically opposite in content, but they have the same mode of integration. They're both misintegration. And that way, the content is not the issue. Not at all the issue.
And in
the mode of thought.
Okay. And then you talk about the four different fields that you survey. Why did you choose the four fields that you did? Physics, literature, and education, and politics.
Ideally I would have written an encyclopedia, but then it would have been impossible to keep the whole history in one's mind at the same time, so I had to restrict myself to a handful of subjects that I thought would be representative. Art and science are obviously two crucial elements of a culture. That's basically between them, that's the essence of a university, general university education. And those are most cases pursued by an individual. So they would, if I take one from each, that would give us an insight into the way creators on an individual level function. So, of course, from art, I took literature because it is the clearest way to know what mode of thought goes into it, because it is all linguistic. So you can find out easily, objectively, what it is that is going on, whereas in a painting or a piece of music, much more difficult to give an objective account. I also think literature happens to be much more influential than any other art, culturally influential. physics, because it is the fundamental science. It is the science on which all other sciences rest, and therefore, it would be ridiculous to take chemistry or astronomy or something. Physics is what you have to take if you want a culture's approach to thinking about the physical world. Now, having looked at two fields that are governed by individual creators, I wanted to look at two which represented big, influential social institutions to give me another aspect of the culture. And if you think about it, there's really only two that affect everybody profoundly in all social institutions. The only ones are your schooling, your education, and the government. Everything else has got much less influence, much less indicative of the culture. So I put those two, and I got four. And that's basically all that a book could cover. I'm trying to take an overview of the whole of history from Greece to the present from the point of view of the mode of thought. You can, if I have three modes of thought and six subcultures and four subjects, you can just imagine the number of combinations. It would be overloaded. No mind, including mine, could hold it if I start multiplying. And I don't think it's necessary. If anybody reads the book, they'll see that the same method can be applied easily to many other areas.
I mean, that was one thing I would want to ask you, is how you were able to do that tour de force of surveying all of those different cultural areas throughout all of those eras in human history. How did you do that? I mean, Obama would say, you couldn't have done that. You didn't build that. It must have been somebody else who did it, right?
He would say that if I wrote my name. I mean, so, you know, I don't think his incredulity is of much value. I did not set out to do that. And if I had understood what my thesis entailed, it's possible I never would have even started the book. I started out really in my very first idea of discussing only the 20th century. And then I got more the idea that there was a development of these same processes from the time of the Renaissance on. It never entered my mind as I was doing the later, nearer centuries that anything more would be required. And then when I, you know, finished my drafts of the modern part from the Renaissance on, I realized that by nature of the claims I was making, there was a huge omission if I didn't do anything with the ancient and medieval period, which is in many ways so different from ours, that it was like generalizing about human history while ignoring our Western history, while ignoring, you know, a huge part of it. So very reluctantly, I dragged myself back to Greece and started over again. finally then caught up again to the Renaissance and ended with one, you know, continuous narrative. But I did not undertake this complex task. It just grew.
which of the fields, and if you want to specify by era, which era was the most difficult for you to work on and grasp? I know that you did get some help from Dave Harriman and some other people on some of the subject areas.
I had a lot of help from Dave Harriman in physics. It would have been impossible for me to even consider including physics without him. I mean, he's a professional physicist, and you know, I was a philosopher, so I had, you know, some grad school courses in physics, but and nothing to speak of. Now, you wanted to know what field I found most difficult?
Right.
Well, if you leave aside physics, which I was really heavily guided by Dave Harriman, so in that sense it was the easiest part. I had no real problems with literature or education. Surprisingly, the field of politics gave me the greatest difficulty.
Now, why is that? Because we all think, oh, politics, you know, that's kind of a lower-level subject. It's certainly not abstract philosophy. Why politics?
Well, I could classify or describe what the essence is of the various, you know, political systems. And some, I was clear what was what the attitude to integration was that they represented. But some it took me a while to work through what exactly is the approach that is being used here. It's not always self-evident. And occasionally, it's the exact opposite of what many of the spokesmen say. You know, in the former that communist dictators used to say they were liberating people and they were great champions of freedom,
right.
When in fact they were the opposite. So you have to be careful as to what a political system really is. And you have to be prepared for similarities where you would not expect them, especially because we're taking the content aside. We're abstracting the method. Now, just to give you an example, Greece, ancient Greece, was a democracy, unlimited majority rule. And jumping out of the Enlightenment, the American founding fathers, they championed capitalism, absolute individual rights, which no one could properly violate, including a majority. So you'd have to say, on the face of it, these are two very different political systems.
Right.
Now, they certainly are, and our democracy, I would argue, had to go the way it did in the ancient world because it's an inherently, profoundly flawed system, whereas the American system didn't have to go the way it did, even though it did. But now, despite that, if you look at the way the Greeks reached the conclusion that democracy was the proper system, it was the same essential mode of integration as the founding fathers.
Right.
The Greeks had less information. They did not have the spectacle of history to know what were the consequences of certain ideas. They were in a special context, you know, the city-state, relatively small, where it never occurred to them, since they were all more or less related or familiar with each other, that negative consequences could come from democracy. But leaving that aside, they defended their approach, and I show you that in detail in the book. They defended their approach by reference to observation. What other states, what were the results of the other states that they were able to observe? And they argued as much as they could for objective truth. They said, although democracy is how we determine the laws, it does not mean that the majority is correct. There are objective laws based on reality and discoverable by observation, and a majority is wrong if it violates these laws. We still, they said, have to let the majority make the decision, but it's not the standard of truth. So in that and many other ways, they were just as reality-oriented. There was no reference to the divine as the basis of their political system or their laws. In that way, I hope you get the idea, but I'm just giving it to you briefly, but two politics that look to be very different have the very same mode of integration.
Now, I wish we could be charitable and say that the people today who call United States a democracy are making, you know, that mistake because our original founding was through a process of proper integration. But unfortunately, we can't say that. People misname America's system a democracy all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But does that answer?
Yes, no,
the reason that politics is most difficult, some of it I just had to discover. I'll have to just give you this as an arbitrary statement, which is discussed in the book, that Karl Marx, who called himself a dialectical materialist, and stresses that he is secular and this worldly, empirical, and scientific. I had to analyze his work, specifically his mode of thought, and demonstrate from that that whatever he calls himself, he is in fact the same as Hegel in mode of integration. He's an idealist and a rationalist, a supernaturalist and a rationalist. And in that way, he is, and the system he advocated is the same mode of integration as the medieval Christianity, with the Pope being the top, omnipotent and infallible, and the communist Stalin or whichever being that. But you have to work. I have to work that out. It's not self-evident. I think it's clear and true, but for some reason, with politics, was harder to organize in my mind than the other subjects.
In terms of your personal learning, I mean, now what you've just described, this going through the process of trying to figure out what's going on in politics, that must have been a tremendous learning process itself. What was the most maybe important or interesting or fun revelation for you in terms of applying your mode of analysis, your method of analysis to all the different subject matters of all the different eras? Was there something that stood out for you?
Well, by fun, it was all excruciating work, so there was not one in which I laughed or had a drink, maybe just for despair at the end of that. So I didn't have any fun that I can see. If you say that, I'm not sure this is a fully thought out answer, but two different things spring out at me. I was, of course, completely hostile to the Obama movement, and it was only in writing out clearly what its mode of integration is that I got some satisfaction that I have finally expressed my view of it in a way that definitively states what I think and gives the basis. And it's not just an arbitrary diatribe because it's integrated to the whole rest of the book. I think of every movement and every field that that I did, I would say that the current American approach is the worst throughout history. And the name of that approach is egalitarianism. I argue that egalitarianism, everybody must be equal, and only ever has been achieved by cutting down the haves in order to allegedly benefit the have-nots. But since the haves are the only ones that kept the have-nots going, the result is that cutting down of everyone, and that egalitarianism, therefore, is out and out nihilism.
Right.
Out and out destruction for its own sake. I give lots of examples and quotes of that, and I was happy to expose that and to show that the whole environmentalist movement is just one aspect of egalitarianism. And that our whole culture is rotting, the whole political side of it is rotting from that kind of nihilism. And by the way, for what it's worth, the publisher asked me to write an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal outlining, my views to get people interested in DIM. So I put in some material, not all, but just a few paragraphs on Obama being a nihilist.
right.
and that it was wrong to call him a socialist. And I don't know what the reason is, but they declined to publish the article. It was a criticism of his that was not the expected, you know, Republican approach. The other
right.
one, the other one, and this is a, was a positive experience. When I finished Greece and got to Rome, Roman literature, I knew that the writer that had to be considered was Virgil, because he was, you know, far and away the soul of Rome. He was to Rome what Homer was to Greece. And I was nervous because my approach to integration required that the Aeneid, his famous epic, have certain definite characteristics. It had to be distinguished in certain ways from the predecessors and the successors, but not in the obvious ways, in the ways of mode of integration. And so I had to list. I'd never read the Aeneid. I had to list the points that had to be in there for my theory to be valid. And if it wasn't valid, then that would raise a big question. If there's a big chunk of human history, you know, which invalidates my thesis, then I don't know where I'm going to be. So I read it with some trepidation, marking in the in the margin whatever I found, and then added it all up at the end. And truly, every single point, without exception on my list, was there unequivocally. It was just exactly what it would have to be. I mean, from the point of view of mode of integration, if my theory were correct. I was totally elated at that, because I figured if I've come up with a theory that can predict how Virgil is going to write, I definitely have something. So that was my most, if you call it fun.
Most fun. And you still...
happiest.
I was going to say, you still wouldn't concede it's fun then, right?
Pardon?
You still wouldn't concede that it was fun, even that.
Well, that was exciting. That definitely was even more than fun. That's I think the one point I remember where I really got some pleasure out of it.
So
it was because the theory had such strong confirmation from that.
Right. And it's also the discovery of your theory having so much power to it. It's not the writing of that point that was fun. It was the learning that you were correct that was fun, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So let's switch a little bit to the U.S. today. You've already said that in terms of politics today, we have egalitarian nihilism, which in the terminology of your book you would call D2, the pure form of disintegration. What about, in brief, the other cultural fields?
What do you mean, today?
Yes, U.S. today.
When?
The U.S. U.S. in 20th century, early 21st.
In terms of the establishment culture, because I make the point that there's the establishment culture, and then there's what I think of as a rebellion against it in the process of working itself up, namely the Christian right, which I think is going to ultimately win out
right.
over today. But it is now not the dominant culture. Well, in essence, I don't want to give a long speech about each of these. The modern culture now would be in literature non-objectivity. In other words, what's called, quote, modern art, a la James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, etc. That is nihilism in the sense of taking the standard classical approach to literature, the approach that was used no matter what else was changed, the elements from Greece on and ripping it apart, like no more connection between events, no events, no more structure, character, no characters, no more organized sentences, word salads, etc. That is just simply nihilism in art. Another example is the whole history, from another aspect of art, the whole history of art or painting has been the attempt to create some kind of image. In modern art, like exemplified by Jason Pollock, who just stands across the room and throws gobs of paint on the wall, on the canvas. Now, that is disintegration as an end in itself. The virtue of that piece, according to the modernists, is that there is no relation between those pieces. They're not supposed to mean anything or connect to anything or relate to each other. They're just arbitrary blobs. And, of course, that's the way they write, too. Now, that is real disintegration. Now, in physics, there are a lot of different approaches today which are not all disintegration. But what I take as disintegration, D2 in physics, is quantum mechanics. As I show, Dave helped me to show, it is a methodical, Heisenberg and Bohr, is a methodical assault on causality, logic, reality. You know the famous Schrodinger experiment? A cat is put in a box, and it's set up as such that you don't know whether some chemical is released or not. And if the cat is released, if the chemical is released, the cat is dead, and if not, not. It's something like that. Right. And their view, their official scientific view, is that when the cat is in the box, under those conditions, it is and it is not dead, and it neither is nor is not dead. It becomes one of those only when we perceive it. And they call this a miracle. That's their official name for it, that you open the box and all these contradictory states collapse into something. You know, you could just add it all up by this. After all these studies of the subatomic world, Bohr was asked, well, what did you finally learn about the atoms? And his answer was, there are no atoms, or there are no, there's no subatomic world. So it is just to physics what non-objective literature is to writing. And then the other one, D2 in education, is Dewey, progressivism in education, you know, which says we learn by doing, not by thinking. And so there's no more classes, textbooks, teachers, no direction by adults. Children are supposed to be just let loose and, perform their, quote, experiments as they wish. There are no more subject divisions. Kids look up or find out at any point at random that they want. no discipline, etc. So obviously the kids don't learn by this method, Dewey has once told, you've given up teaching and you've given up learning, And his answer, which I quote in the book, I can't quote it from memory, was there is a little social value to be gained by mere individual learning. So, I mean, that's the revolution in literature. There's no literature in physics. That there's nothing for physics to study in education. That there is no teaching or learning, and in politics, it's so much from so opposite from being protecting individual rights. It's a mass slaughter of the individual.
Right. Right. So basically, in today, the establishment culture is D2 across the board.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. There are little pockets here and there, like string theory, is a reversion to more old-fashioned rationalism.
Okay.
What's left of Einstein that hasn't been absorbed into other fields was again, a more old-fashioned view. So... You know, there's always, there can be some pockets, but the dominant approach is what I said. And this has never existed before.
And
first of all, I define three philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, and Kant, as being the source of these three attitudes. And the D approach... Well, it started with Kant in the 18th century. So there never was a D culture before Kant. It started only in the 19th century and reached its full blossoming in the 20th. So there never has been a society like this. And ours is, you know, relatively recent that it started. It only got into politics maybe 20, 25, 30 years ago, you know, with all the political correctness. And environmentalism was the start of the movement.
What I liked, one of the formulations in the book, is when you talked about Kant appealing to rage. And
yes.
I connected that with what I watch when I watch Obama speak. He seems to me often, especially when he's speaking about businessmen and bankers, that he is containing rage. He's trying to control himself from expressing rage more than he does. I mean, obviously, I think that he is expressing rage, but he seems like he's got so much within him, he can't contain it. And so when you see the influence of Kant to create an Obama, you see it clearly. I mean, I don't know if you watch his speeches. It's very hard to do, but occasionally I watch. And
well, I am just seeing sort of clips here now, but the thing that struck me, you know, a socialist would denounce the rich while presenting a vision, you know, of the poor and how desperate they are and how they're going to transform human nature and bring about, you know, a world of perfect harmony. They're going to kill the exploiters, but the focus is going to be on, you know, the glory to come. He doesn't even utter a peep about that. He just makes a few perfunctory remarks about this will help the people who don't have insurance, but he's really interested in knocking down the insurance company. That's when he comes to life. So I think his what interests him is clear.
Right. Now, in the book, you actually predict, though, I mean, you know, these nihilists are terrible. They are destroying values left and right to the extent that they can. And in the book, nonetheless, you predict that what is going to take over and what is going to cause, you know, the most harm to us in the long term is an M2, a misintegration culture. Now, you say it's not absolutely certain that this is going to happen. It could take a number of decades, et cetera. But one of the things I was interested in is that you say that there is a trigger event that is going to perhaps happen and then allow a charismatic M2, a charismatic misintegrator, to take over. Would that trigger event be the economic destruction that someone like an Obama has wrought? Or could it be the sort of thing that maybe is starting now in the Middle East because of his destructive foreign policy?
You're missing. I wrote a whole section on the fact that a triggering event could be one or more. And then I listed examples from politics, economics, foreign policy. You know, so it could be a combination of all of it. You know, for example, suppose in the name of equality, he were to dictate that the Koran had to be in every hotel room next to the Gideon Bible.
Right.
You know, I think that that would cause a big enrage, and if you combine that with, you know, the economic disasters, which are inescapable now. There's no way for anyone to prevent the economic disasters, given the deficit and the out of control spending, which they are not going to be able to control, without abandoning the welfare state, which they can't and won't do. So it's going to be crises that make 1929 look like pleasant by comparison. And then there's the foreign triggers. Pretty clear that Obama is going to appease to the end and give in to whatever many of these hostile countries want, as he's just he sanctions it, and at the same time, he's hostile toward Israel, for example, who is a friend. But it's pretty clear that at some point, he's going to give too much of America away in terms of America's standing. Now, I guess it's conceivable that people will just simply let it all happen and throw up their hands and be beaten into the ground, into serfs, without protest. I guess that's barely possible. But I don't really consider that an actual possibility. Not of any significance. Because, after all, we're still civilized. We're still able, on some level, to observe and evaluate. And there is already a very broad movement which has a strong viewpoint, a complete ideology or a complete philosophy dictating their actions. And Obama and that whole egalitarian crowd, by contrast, not only has no philosophy, they proudly have no philosophy. If you ask them, you know, what is the long-range state of the world that you're aiming for, they say, we don't have utopian goals. We deal with today's problem today. So they offer people nothing in the form of hope. And Christianity, whether you like it or not, offers them a whole way of life and a hope. Therefore, to me, it seems obvious that the worse we get under nihilism, the stronger Christianity is going to get, and there's no other force. And at some point, I'll give it up to 50 years, but it's probably not that long. At some point, the disasters of life are going to reach the stage where there'll be a rebellion. At least I can't, it's hard to imagine that wouldn't happen.
Now, why wouldn't we, even if we elect some Christians, say, into office, why wouldn't we continue the longstanding United States policy of the separation of church and state? Why wouldn't that be a block to the M2 taking over here?
Because, first of all, by the time that happens, we'll be more or less a dictatorship established by the left. That will be an established form of government, and the left propaganda will have been institutionalized and mandated. And if there is a revolution, the first thing they're going to do, they're not going to go back and say, let's go back to the Enlightenment with individual rights, because these fundamentalist Christians are ridiculous. The Enlightenment is simply an invalid era to them. So they're going to come and say, we are going to throw you out and mandate our ideology because yours is immoral, yours is ungodly, et cetera, et cetera. There are no groups left, major groups left, who uphold individual rights. There's only different ways of attacking them, and who is going to end up? I think you can say separation of church and state by the time this happens. That will be considered an impious statement.
Okay. So in terms of what could actually prevent the M2 from taking over our culture, in the book you discuss that the American sense of life could do it, and, of course, the influence of an I philosophy, a proper integrative philosophy, which in the ancient world was Aristotle and today is Ayn Rand's philosophy, of course. In terms of the American sense of life, would you say that the enthusiasm that people have over computer technology, so, for example, Apple had a big announcement today. I haven't even seen what it is yet, but, you know, new products announced by Apple cause a huge stir everywhere, and everyone is excited about it.
It's been a huge stir everywhere and everyone. Give me some approximate numbers. How many people do you think are involved in this huge stir?
I mean, I think millions of people buy iPhones, so they're enthusiastic.
Millions of people, and there's hundreds of millions in the country.
True.
And millions of people who are excited about a piece of technology are not necessarily at all people who embrace the philosophic underpinnings of technology.
And okay.
It's entirely different things.
So that you would count as pretty insignificant in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I think it's goodies. It's the last reward of Western civilization, but it doesn't indicate. I don't. Is there any country except total cannibals who wouldn't get excited if you gave them a whole bunch of technology that works? I mean, if they had enough education to use it, I don't think that's American sense.
What about the whole "you didn't build that" movement that has happened now? I mean, the uproar at our president saying to businessmen, whether he misspoke a little bit or not, you know, this is really what he thinks.
He misspoke. That is absolutely essential to egalitarianism. The modern founder was John Rawls, and Rawls' whole argument for egalitarianism was that you're born with your brain and you're born with the environment that's around you, and that makes possible everything else that you do. And therefore, you did not achieve anything. You merely lucked out. And it's your brain and your environment that get the credit. But that isn't you. And therefore, you didn't build that. That is 100% pure egalitarianism.
Right. And so what about the reaction to this from the American public?
He did not misspeak. At all. He said a perfectly clear statement of his actual view.
Right. But then the reaction to it, the outpouring of outrage by the American public and saying, no, you know, we the small businessmen, we did build that. You know, Romney has built part of his campaign on reacting to this and saying, yes, you did build that. You know, Romney doesn't go as far as saying that you should be proud of the fact that you built it, but he says we should acknowledge you and we want to encourage you in building things, of course, you know. But do you take the healthy reaction to "you didn't build that" as a sign of the American sense of life being alive
and
well? No. Okay.
No, I don't, because I don't think that's distinctively American, but even if suppose it was, it's a good reaction. If somebody insults you, insults what you've done with your life, and you get angry, that's an excellent reaction. If you can say what you believe that makes that wrong, but if all you can say is, look, I work 24 hours a day, that is not any kind of defense. That is not a viewpoint. It's just a concrete. If you had the idea this is an assault on human achievement, coming from a source that wants to destroy values because it rejects reality. If there was any kind of response to that, then I would say, in other words, if that's what the response came from, any form of that, then I would say it's a really good sign. But to me, it's just a sign of people are hurt by saying a mean aspersion against them. So it's a good sign that they're hurt, but I don't know what that proves. But maybe this is not a good time for me to talk, because I just read more polls that now put Obama in the lead, even though narrowly. And in my opinion, if someone could have the 4 years that Obama had and do what he did on every front, and nevertheless, over half the country or the registered voters want to retain him, and you put that together with the fact that something like half the country is on welfare or on government payments,
right,
and that every definable pressure group seems to capitulate to the Obama's bribery. He offers, one law to the Hispanics, and and something to the blacks, and something to the Jews. Although the Jews, he just lost by his attitude to refuse to meet their prime minister. Women are suddenly now, he's going to woo them by free contraception. He's literally buying out the public. And he seems to be succeeding, from what I can tell.
Well, so, I don't know if you remember.
That indifferent, what has gone on. And, that easily bought out what does it mean to say they have a sense of life if they're indignant at what you said, but nevertheless he's voted in?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure which poll you looked at. I've seen some of these polls in the last several days, and yes, they're showing Obama in the lead. But I heard that in the time of Carter Reagan, the same thing in the months before, that the polls were showing that Carter was going to win, and then Reagan wins by a landslide. So I'm not sure if we can trust
him. Let me just tell you, I hope, if I believed in God, I would pray that you are right. But there's just a little tiny difference between Reagan and Romney. Now, I'm not a big supporter of Reagan, but Reagan is a giant compared to Romney, who is beneath a pygmy. He's nothing. He's deliberately, as a mode, a strategy of running for office, not want to offend anybody. That is stated publicly several times. Conservatives are begging him to say something, to fight, to all he wants to say is he has a lot of experience and he will fix everything. Oh, yes, and by the way, he's thrown in, not going to raise taxes on anybody but the rich, and I'm going to repeal Obamacare, but we're going to keep the provisions that if you have, you can't be kicked out of insurance if you have a prior illness, and we'll keep the one about the kid can stay at home until he's 26. So, this man is a nothing turning into a Democrat before our eyes right now. I don't think he can win the way he is, but if he wins, what is his administration going to do? Is he going to slow things down? He could be knocked over by anybody.
Right. Now, but as wimpy and inconsequential as Romney is, and I agree with you there, isn't Obama that much worse, if not more, than Carter?
All I can say is Obama has certain things going for him. The major one of which is that he is black, and that a great number of people in this country consider it a real virtue on their part to vote for a black.
Okay.
I honestly believe that if he were identical in every way, his looks, everything, but he wasn't black, he would have been way down in the polls, way down. But they have bought the idea that it's a heroic achievement to keep a black in office no matter what, and that's the difference.
So here's the question. If M2 is the big danger, first of all, does Romney even represent an M2, or is he so inconsequential that he can't represent anything? And then
Romney is a D1.
Okay.
There are no M1s anymore. Romney is a D1. In other words, he's an advocate of a mixed economy. He wants to have some capitalism and some controls, and he just struggles from crisis to crisis without any guiding principle.
So if people say,
as I show in the book, D1 moves gradually toward D2. So
right.
Romney would be like a step back historically to before Obama, but he would just move back to that. So you
wouldn't see a vote if you go in the ballot box and click the Romney Ryan option this November. That is not a vote to push us towards M2 in your mind.
Let me put it this way. Romney is not religious. A vote for him is necessary because Obama will end the country in 4 years. And if there's to be any hope of survival, he has to be defeated. Romney himself will not institutionalize religion. But he is going to give tremendous power to the religious wing of the Republicans, because he's going to continue the status mess, the shambles, all the rest of it. And then when the next election comes, they're going to say, all right, you tried a moderate secular candidate, and you wrecked everything. You got to put in someone that we represent. In other words, they're going to assert themselves, I think, after the moderate wing has his last gasp. I can't give the timing, but that is my view. So that in that sense, Romney, long range is helping the Republicans, but long range is too long now. Right now, I think we have to try to get four more years where there's still freedom of speech, and you don't have to be the president, anybody who disagrees with his views, you know about that website they have.
Attack Watch, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable what's happening.
So I promise not to keep you going over an hour, so we're going to wrap up here pretty quick. I just have one quick little question, because we have been doing an intervention series, as we call it, on my radio show, and we have been trying to convince people that they should not throw away their vote to Gary Johnson in this election, that it's essential to get Obama out. And one question that people have had is, well, are you endorsing Romney if you pull the lever for him or whatever it is in November? It's not an endorsement, right?
You are endorsing 4 years of survival. If two people come at you, one is right in front of you with a cannon, and the other is 5 miles away with a rifle running to get you, I would get rid of the cannon first if I could do so by stopping the other. I mean, they're both threats, but one is immediate. It's not an issue of endorsing. It's an issue of if you have two destroyers after you, you have to get rid of the immediate one. And the fact that you do something as you approve the other is irrelevant to endorsement.
Right.
You're choosing between people who are going to destroy you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, because this is a point I've been trying to make, and I appreciate you helping me with that. One quick question before we go. How has your book been doing? This is an abstract work of philosophy. And I think I've heard you before say on your podcast that you didn't expect it to sell very well. How are you doing with it?
Well, I am truly amazed. Now, give me just one fact. Amazon, you probably know, has a list of all the books there are arranged according to how much they sell. Like the biggest seller is one, and I think the worst is 1 million. And they, update it every hour. So, I mean, the number I give you may not be fresh. My understanding, which may be mistaken, is that if you can get into five digits, like for the 55,000, you're doing okay. The publisher is satisfied. Well, believe it or not, with this technical book by an unknown author, today, are you ready for this?
Okay.
I was 653.
653, and just for the record...
Of all books, I mean, to get into three digits for this kind of book is just impossible.
That is wonderful. Today, just for the record, we're recording this on September 12th. So this is 8 days after the release of your book, and you're at 653 in the rank on Amazon.
Yeah, well, for the 1 hour, who knows, they change it each hour.
Yeah, it changes.
But I've been told that for this kind of book, that's really something.
So the publisher must be pleased.
I guess so, yep.
Excellent, excellent. Well, congratulations.
I really can't believe it. So.
I'll have one more question that I'm going to submit to your podcast. If people want to check out your weekly podcast, they go to peekoff.com. And, of course, there at peekoff.com, they can purchase. There's a link there to purchase The Dim Hypothesis, Why the Lights of the West Are Going Out. You can also find it and comment on this show at my blog at don'tletitgo.com. Leonard, thank you so much for spending this hour with us, and I really appreciate it. It's been very helpful, and I wish you the best success with this book.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed being on. You're certainly a better interviewer than some of them.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.